You're listening to Community Conversations on the Forum on the Hill. From 4 to 6 p.m. each day this week, we'll talk with lawmakers, educators, health professionals, and local leaders in an effort to promote collaboration on community-wide issues. Let's navigate the path forward together. Presented by Alliance Health, Chapel Hill Transit, Durham Technical Community College, Grub Properties, Trinsic Residential Group, and UNC Health. The Forum on the Hill. Only on 97.9 The Hill and chapelboro.com.
Welcome into the Forum on the Hill here on 97.9 The Hill. I am Brighton McConnell, and we are so glad to be hosting this Forum series once again, streaming on chapelboro.com, and for those folks listening out there on the radio, on 97.9 The Hill FM and 1360 AM. As we know, we host this series because our community, like all communities, have so many different parts, pockets, elements that make it unique and are why we love where we live. But of course, we know that it's not perfect. We know that there are so many different challenges out there. And we also know that the spirit of collaboration here in our home is truly strong. And that's why we're hosting this series once again this year, to have deep discussions about what's going on, good and bad, and to figure out what our community not only needs to know, but also how we can move forward through different things. Over the next few days, we're going to be hearing from panels on topics like our downtowns in Chapel Hill and Carrboro, our arts industry, social justice, higher education. If you want to check out the full lineup and schedule for what we've got planned between 4 and 6 o'clock each day this week, visit chapelboro.com. But today, for our first panel, we begin with K through 12 education, which we know is always one of the top things that our community is interested and focused on here because we have such strong school districts. Joining me is a great lineup for what should be a very, very good panel over the next hour. We have Dr. Naya Hamlett, who is the superintendent of Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools, joining us to represent CHCCS. And from Orange County Schools, we have Connie Crimmins, who's the Executive Director of Exceptional Children and Pre-K Services, as well as Dr. Chris Gammon, who is the Executive Director of Curriculum and Instruction. There is a lot to get into, but before we truly get started, I want to thank each of you for taking the time for joining us today here on 97.9 The Hill and our first forum panel of the year. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Well, I think the place where it makes sense to start is maybe the biggest story over the last year, which is, of course, the return to classrooms, public health in schools. Orange County Schools returned to in-person instruction back in January this year. CHCCS returned in March, and there's definitely been some growing pains. Obviously, the COVID-19 pandemic changed a lot in terms of how people are approaching education and the students are approaching their own learning. So kind of want to take a step by looking at how the public health measures are going, because we know that so many different places have different strategies to how they approached it. Let's start with CHCCS. Dr. Hamlett, you and I speak pretty regularly on Speaking of Schools, so we have the benefit of knowing some of what CHCCS's moves were. But to rehash some of that, and since it's been kind of a full year since it was on people's mind when we were back in remote learning, can you share a little bit about what some of the public health measures have been in CHCCS schools for the last few months?
Sure. So for this school year, we started, and we're still with universal masking. And for us, we require masks both indoors and outdoors. We certainly still adhere to the maximum extent possible, the physical distancing when we can. But at the same time, we also want to encourage collaborative instruction and good instructional practices that sometimes, you know, physical distancing can be a barrier to. So we try to really approach our COVID protocols and our strategies kind of from a layered approach. And then we've also, we require full vaccination for all employees. Our athletes are either have to be fully vaccinated or they have to test. Goodness, we have so many strategies in place. It's definitely a multi-layered approach, and something that we think has really shown to be helpful in our school district, because our numbers are quite low and the majority of the positive cases that have been confirmed in our district have been related to exposure outside of school.
Got it. And I was going to say, it's hard to remember, too, because it's been gradual. I mean, there were things that were put in place back at the beginning of the year that are no longer in place, and things have developed over time, which, turning now to Orange County schools, I know that's especially the case since you guys returned to in-person learning back in January. I'm not sure which between the two of you, either Connie or Chris, who might be best to answer this, but what are some of the public health measures that Orange County schools have had in place, still have in place?
Sure. Very similar to Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools. I do know that our superintendent, Dr. Felder, as well as our school board, have done a tremendous job of trying to remain tightly aligned with guidance from the ABC Science Collaborative, as well as the Orange County Health Department, making sure that the measures that we're taking, whether it's masking, whether it's social distancing measures, the athletics, as was just mentioned, those pieces, we've tried to remain in a very steadfast, tight alignment with the guidance that's there and the health guidance. I do know that we've made some obvious adjustments over time where we've been able to kind of slowly scale back on some of the restrictions. But that's often been through much deliberation, trying to take into account, you know, all of the factors, whether it's for our students, our staff, our support staff that are coming in and out of the buildings, and just making sure that we remain as close to that guidance as possible.
And it seems like, similar to CHCCS, pretty high success rates too. We've not seen very many clusters breaking out at Orange County schools. You know, obviously lots of variants out there and lots of different variables to deal with when it comes to this, but we haven't been seeing kind of a widespread of the virus like some people might have feared too. So that being said, I just mentioned the variants, and part of the sliding scale, part of the adjustments, of course, have been with how this virus continues to change. And we are still obviously learning about the latest of the Omicron variant. It feels like we've known a lot about the Delta variant, but that's only been around really in the U.S. and in our community for a couple of months. So are the school districts, and I'm turning back to you now, Dr. Hamlet, are the school districts already and always looking at ways to try and stay on top of these public health measures?
Absolutely. And I would say the main point, and Chris brought it up, is really staying in collaboration with the experts in this area. You know, we went to school to be educators, not public health officials. So really relying heavily on the ABC Science Collaborative and our local health department has been key. And then aside from that, I would just say staying the course and just kind of that level of thankfulness to be able to offer vaccines to our 5 to 11-year-olds, because I know that that's something that's been top of mind for our families of young children.
Yes, that actually takes me right into my next topic, because that's also a big part in terms of keeping down spread and how the school districts have been approaching this, and certainly something that's different right now than we saw at the end of last school year is the presence and the eligibility of all of the students in these districts, with the exception of pre-K students being able to have these shots. So I want to turn back to you guys with Orange County Schools, and Connie, you might be able to comment on this. How has the vaccine effort been looking so far in Orange County Schools? Because I know that it is through some partnerships with the county government.
Right. So again, working with our Orange County Health Department and working with our community partners, we have been able to set up vaccine clinics, which have been a success. We were able to set them up in all of our elementary when the vaccine just recently came out for them, and then along with our middle schools and high schools. And again, everything we talk about today really is a partnership. So we have community partners, and again, our board and Dr. Felder are so supportive of health measures. I also think that one of the important things is, even though some of our students can be vaccinated, we still need to keep up with the precautions, because we know that, as we've seen with COVID, it's ever morphing. And so knowing that there are students and staff who, for certain reasons, cannot be vaccinated, we need to respect that health and safety measures have to be in place to protect all members of our community.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, of course, you being the executive director of pre-K services, that means that some of your work is overlooking students who are still not eligible. And I imagine that that presents its own set of challenges for those families and those kids.
Right. So you're talking about sometimes 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds masking. And they've not, I think one of the interesting facts is in school that they've not known different. So they are able to mask, and they mask beautifully. We have Some of the challenges, though, have been because pre-K has licensing, so there's sanitation and making sure that we are upholding those, as well as kind of doing over sanitation. So wiping down tables more frequently, eating outside. That is a huge measure, because when the mask comes off, we want to make sure that our students, our staff is able to distance, and then that extra measure of being outside.
Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. Want to turn back to you now, Dr. Hamlet. How has the vaccination effort been going for CHCCS? It's been a little while since you and I have been able to catch up on that, and I imagine that there has been some progress, even though this is still kind of like an ongoing effort for kids who are under 12 years old in North Carolina.
Yeah, so we've had a number of vaccine clinics all the way dated back to last spring, but most recently we've had two clinics for our 5 to 11 year olds, and we've vaccinated somewhere in the range of 500 to 600 students. But I also know that, you know, local pediatricians and other community vaccinators have been very helpful. And from what I understand, the doors have been open and revolving just with the families who have been taking advantage of getting the vaccine for their children. So people aren't just doing it in schools, but they're also connected with their local pediatricians to get that done.
We're speaking with Dr. Nya Hamlet, who you were just hearing there. She's the superintendent of Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools. Also joining us for our K-12 education panel today, Connie Crimmins of Orange County Schools. She's the executive director of Exceptional Children and Pre-K Services for that district, as well as Dr. Chris Gammon, who is the executive director of Curriculum and Instruction. And we've been talking more and more as we are getting into this kind of new normal, this lived-in phase of the COVID-19 pandemic, of when is the time to continue adjusting, either changing up our masking, changing up vaccine efforts. And so I'm curious, I want to turn back to you again, Dr. Hamlet. Can you share some of the district's long-term goals when it comes to ensuring public health and safety in the school communities? Because it doesn't feel like we're at a time yet to be making any changes, with variants still popping up and people still working to get their children vaccinated or themselves vaccinated. But I'm sure the districts are already kind of thinking of, okay, what's the next step and what are we looking at doing 5 years, 10 years from now, since this virus isn't going away?
Yeah, that's right. So I would say that, again, as Chris said, staying in close contact with the experts. So the ABC Science Collaborative and the Health Department have been a tremendous help in helping us to kind of assess our metrics along the way and determine when we might begin to start to peel back some of those layers. I agree that now is not necessarily the time for that. And we also have to be mindful of kind of what our community is saying to us. And I can tell you, in Chapel Hill Carrboro, our community overwhelmingly is still very supportive of masking and, of course, you know, making the vaccine available to everyone who's able to get it. So with that said, it is still a requirement for school boards to vote every month on masking in particular. And so I think that is an opportunity to really look at those metrics as time goes on and as, you know, new variants are in play, to make the best informed decision for our community while also making sure that we're not operating out of fear. And what I've really been able to see, and I've seen this progression since the start of the school year, where teachers and students really weren't sure what to do as it relates to, in particular, to physical distancing. And now when I'm in classrooms, I see that people are starting to feel more comfortable, and, you know, it's kind of starting to feel a little bit more like a true classroom environment where, there, like I said, there's that collaborative learning going on. And so I'm grateful, again, just to be in a district where we're making informed decisions, but we're also not operating out of fear.
Sure. And turning back to Orange County Schools, that's actually a good question that I probably should have just asked off the top. How are things going in classrooms? What is the feeling among students and staff right now as we've gotten used to how things have been going in this latest school year?
Well, you know, it's fascinating, because that immediate and sudden pivot to remote learning that occurred when the pandemic began, I mean, it forced us into a space where we were having to essentially retrain ourselves as educators while having students in front of us, and it oftentimes having our own children in home with us teaching from that space. I think going through a sudden shift like that, you pick up a lot of really powerful forward-thinking and innovative approaches to learning. to then transition back into the school setting, it's kind of finding that blend or that balance now of how can we continue to use some of those best practices that we had in place prior to the pandemic and kind of mold those with some of these more online, innovative, you know, digital learning practices that we've learned there. And I think that space oftentimes is where you're kind of grappling with a struggle, you know, and I think for our teachers, any teachers that I've had conversations with, any students that we've communicated with, they have all expressed this excitement and enthusiasm of being back in person and being present. But they also are very transparent that it's not the same as it was prior to the pandemic. And I think that constantly being open to that dialogue, that problem solving together, and just learning in that space. I'm excited to see the direction that we're going to go in the future, but we're kind of in that grind space right now where we're just learning and seeing if we can make the best of it.
Connie Kermans, do you want to build off of that too from your perspective from EC kids and
sure.
pre-K students?
Absolutely. I'm going to talk about our students with disabilities because we have a wide range. And so I'm going to start with our students with the most significant needs. We brought them back into buildings in October of 2020. So it's they were the first. And I called our teachers our pioneers. And so we've had students back in the building since October. What we have learned from that, though, is the relationship with parents, especially for our students with the most significant needs. That relationship has only strengthened, and we, our teachers have found, and our teacher assistants and our parents have found this new kind of blending of, we can support you more at home, we can support you more in school. The other really positive thing that has come out of this is, as you can imagine, some of our students with disabilities do have some intense medical needs, where being in person right now would be a detriment. It's not safe for them. And so our teachers are still using that blended learning where they still have students on Zoom and they come in. And so we've been able to provide them with this same rich experience. I also have to give kudos to our teachers in our low incidence population classrooms. The learning was seamless. Like, they taught the heck out of those kids last year. I can't express it any different. And seeing when they returned and the language development was amazing. And so now we've been able to continue this growth throughout this school year. For our students who have disabilities who are in the general education classroom, that's been a little more of a challenge because of the their need to access the general education curriculum, so they weren't with a special education teacher all day. And so really talking about what accommodations can we use in that remote environment that are now going to move into the new space of being back in school. The good thing is that everyone is so happy to be back. And we've seen that with our pre-K students too. The same thing applies. We have pre-K students with very deep, intense medical needs. Mm-hmm. And again, how to make sure that they are safe within the school environment. We are seeing that the precautions that have been put in place, so all of our classrooms have, or the majority have, two air purifiers, but especially in those classrooms where there's going to be some students who cannot wear a mask because of their medical need. And our rule was, if you can take it on and off independently, then you would wear a mask. If you were not able to, then no mask was required. Because as you can imagine, we don't want to ever set up a kid to be unsafe.
Right.
But with our pre-K students, it's been seamless. They have just come in and they're learning. And again, as Dr. Hamlet has said, as we've moved into the school year further, the collaborative learning, the paired experience, because pre-K is about play, learning through play, social emotional learning, and they've been able to strike a balance between being safe and those safety protocols and what is good teaching.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think you made an important point there. I think so many people are happy that the kids are back in the classrooms. I mean, it is definitely a big step for students, staff, to all be back together, and also for parents, as you mentioned, Chris, to be able to not always have to be around their kids. But there is also no doubt that there's also been a big mental health effect. Mm-hmm. on that return and from that year or so of remote learning. And Dr. Hamlet, you and I have talked about this in the past. It's something that we're continuing to see in so many different ways. And I know that CHCCS has taken some steps already this school year to try and address mental well-being. But can you reiterate again just the impact on mental health that you are either seeing in students or that your staff is seeing in students or that you're just hearing from the community based on this last year?
Yeah, so, you know, that's definitely one of our priorities and just maintaining not just safety, but wellness overall. I think one of the things that we've tried to focus on a little more is we talk a lot about having a continuum of services for students, but also figuring out how to do that for staff as well. Sometimes I think we underestimate that analogy of, you know, the adults being able to put their oxygen mask on first. And so we're trying to find ways to provide as much wellness and social emotional support for our employees just as much as we are for our students. We do have mental health specialists in our secondary schools. Could always use more. We certainly have co-located mental health services available in our schools. So we're seeing some things that, and knowing that those things are helpful. We have a social emotional learning curriculum. But one thing that I actually just sent to our principals and we'll be diving a little bit deeper into is a universal SEL screener. And it basically shows data on where we were, or where our students were, and how they were feeling last spring as compared to how they feel this fall now that they are back in person. And one of the things that our students have cited is really a lack of feelings of a lack of connectivity. And we've seen a decrease in teacher-to-student relationships, and this is, again, from the student perspective, feelings of safety and school climate. And so we're seeing those declines in student perceptions about that, and so we're really trying to be intentional and mindful about how do we then address those things. And then I also just sent a message to our principals to say, hey, don't wait for a quantitative data point, right? Yes, we have these great tools that can kind of assess based on surveys how our students are feeling. But if there is any feeling or inkling that there is a student or an employee or a community member, for that matter, in our buildings who may be experiencing some type of trauma or, emotional or mental issue, then we need to figure out how to problem solve together and as a collaborative community, because it's, as you see with recent events, it's so very important to be vigilant and supportive at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that it's been similar for Orange County schools, students, and that experience there. Mm-hmm. I do want to turn to you quickly here, Connie. Yeah. Are there any mental health challenges for EC students, pre-K students, or is that more on the families of those who, you know, are kind of more acutely aware of everything that's been going on with the pandemic and how learning has shifted?
Yeah. So I view mental health support as collaborative. We have to work in partnership with our parents, especially those who have diagnosed mental health and sometimes those who don't. I think COVID has exacerbated some. Also, I think another thing is to remember is that our current K-1 students have never been, especially our first graders, they had school at home, right? Mm-hmm. So those routines, those natural routines and that connection with the teacher, it was very different at the beginning of last year. So teaching them the routines, teaching them that teachers are safe, school is a safe place, and just starting with those basic premises. We started last year with supports for teachers, giving them a space to talk about either world events, because, you know, not just what happened last week, but if you think about the last year and a half, so many changes in our world and in our nation have prompted discourse amongst our educators. And then how do you work with students? So it wasn't just COVID in and of itself, but it was COVID and. Mm-hmm. And so making sure that we have school-based mental health, we have a highly trained counselor and social worker staff, our school psychologists are there to assist. And then making sure our teachers can see the early warning signs. Mm-hmm. All of those things, coupled with working with parents, I think helps us create a comprehensive what means to serve students.
Chris, turning to you and kind of building off of what Connie just mentioned there, are there any mental health, maybe not issues, but certainly mental health conversations that have been heightened or maybe have even taken a back seat in the last year because of the COVID pandemic? I think a lot of focus, rightfully so, is on the mental health impact of that. But we know that many students, especially looking at people in middle school and high school based on current events and just everything that's happened in the last decade or so, certainly facing more mental health challenges and talking about them than before, too.
Oh, absolutely. I do know that our student support services team, Ms. Sherita Cobb, that they've done a tremendous job of trying to stay current and up to date on what those, you know, most pressing mental health challenges are, not only nationally, but here locally. I believe it is that discourse, as Connie said, and even Dr. Hamlet referenced earlier. I know that our teachers are in this space of great vulnerability in a positive way, where they've been able to share with us and be very open in their dialogue of things that they're seeing and how students have come back maybe in a different light than they were when they saw them last in person. I do think it's that open dialogue. And I think one piece for us that has been a positive in the pandemic has been a way to leverage technology for that type of communication and collaboration. I've seen a huge uptick in the conversations that are happening across schools, sometimes impromptu, oftentimes things that we're able to structure and schedule, but those types of professional learning community type conversations, not only around mental health, but also around academic related things. Teachers, you could be a third grade teacher at one elementary school, whereas 2-3 years ago, you may not have had a conversation with a fellow third grade teacher at a neighboring school at all. Now you find yourself on these kind of collaborative conversation groups all the time, talking about these different pressing, you know, issues that you're mentioning. I think that's one way that we've learned. It is a quantitative data piece, as Dr. Hamlet referenced, where we're surveying, where we do have social emotional learning curriculum, but it's really that qualitative feedback that we're getting on the ground from those support services that we've tried to budget and try to increase their presence in buildings.
And it's also worth mentioning, it's not just feedback about how the students are doing, it's about how the staff are doing too.
Absolutely.
We know that they are equally as affected by all of this. Well, we do have our break coming up, but to kind of put at least a little bit of a bow on this mental health conversation, it's always hard to try and cover all of this within a little bit of time. I do want to turn back to you, Dr. Hamlet. I know CHCCS has worked in a couple of mental wellness days already this part of the school year, likely going to be some next year too. But in your mind, as you lead the district, how are you hoping to make that even more of a priority in terms of how you're approaching helping out CHCCS?
Yeah, well, you know, I think one of the things that is top of mind for us is really looking at how we can be strategic about using our calendar and the parameters associated with it in order to create wellness activities built into the instructional day. So that it doesn't, you know, it's not another burden on families to not have students in school. So I think that's one thing. And then really just equipping our teachers and our educators with the tools that they need to, as Connie mentioned, really understand and know when those early warning signs are present. And then I think, you know, just really thinking about, and this is just a data point that we continue to put in front of our community, that almost 8 years ago in 2014, 1 in 5 students in North Carolina had an identified emotional, behavioral, or developmental disability. That was 8 years ago before the pandemic. So when we talk about the challenges associated with the pandemic and being exacerbated by the pandemic, it's really something that we have to, it just has to kind of be part of our new normal, if you will. And so we're just looking forward to kind of maximizing the opportunities and really looking at the lessons learned that the pandemic has brought us and incorporating that into the new norm for CHCCS.
We're speaking with Dr. Nia Hamlet of CHCCS, as well as Connie Crimmins and Dr. Chris Gammon of Orange County Schools. Going to take a quick break here on the Forum on the Hill, but we'll continue talking with these three in our K-12 education panel when we come back. You're listening to 97.9 The Hill.
Stay tuned for more community conversations on the Forum, on the Hill, only on 97.9 The Hill and chapelboro.com. From 4 to 6 p.m. each day this week, we'll talk with lawmakers, educators, health professionals, and local leaders in an effort to promote collaboration on community-wide issues. Let's navigate the path forward together. Presented by Alliance Health, Chapel Hill Transit, Durham Technical Community College, Grub Properties, Trinsic Residential Group, and UNC Health. The Forum on the Hill, only on 97.9 The Hill and chapelboro.com.
Orange County residents looking for an affordable way to continue your education can pick up a new skill or change careers with courses at the Durham Tech Orange County campus. Located in Hillsboro, students have access to healthcare programs like anesthesia technology, EMS, and nurse aid, and courses in photography, sewing, computers, and English or Spanish. Visit durhamtech.edu to learn more. If you live in Orange County and are insured by Medicaid or have no health insurance, meet Alliance Health. Beginning in December, we'll be your bridge to care for mental illness, substance use disorders, and intellectual or developmental disabilities. We're already on the ground listening to community leaders across Orange County to learn how we can work together to manage quality care that helps folks thrive and live their best lives. Visit us today at alliancehealthplan.org.
Trinsic Residential Group, the firm behind the Aura development, is proud to sponsor a new monthly segment, the Nonprofit Spotlight. Each month, Ryan Stewart from Trinsic will invite a worthy nonprofit from our community to our station to explain their mission and message. Trinsic Residential is committed to placemaking, best-in-class planning, and construction practices in supporting our community. Thank you, Trinsic Residential Group, for supporting our local nonprofits.
Jerry and Tina Bell have lived in Chapel Hill for more than 50 years, but still have a fondness for their first home, a cozy two-bedroom apartment in the iconic Glen Lennox neighborhood. Bell remembers carpooling to campus in a loud 1955 Hudson, and Tina recalls sharing wonderful walks with the Baby Carriage Brigade. Read about the Bells and other residents over the last six decades, such as Bland Simpson and Roy Williams, in Glen Lennox Stories in the Town Square section of chapelboro.com.
Chapel Hill Transit is now hiring. They're seeking energetic, passionate, and mission-driven individuals to drive their buses. If you have a great attitude and great customer service skills, they want to meet you. No experience is necessary, and Chapel Hill Transit offers paid training and excellent benefits. Full and part-time positions are available, and they offer flexible shifts. Find out more online at townofchapelhill.org/jobs. Again, that's townofchapelhill.org/jobs.
From star athletes to superfans, UNC Health is dedicated to caring for champions of all kinds. For you, the latest advancements and our greatest expertise are always in play to deliver personalized care with the utmost compassion. It's the kind of care that keeps champions like you and your family in the game when it matters the most. See our lineup at unchealthcare.org/sports.
Welcome back to Community Conversations on the Forum, on the Hill. See the full schedule of forum topics by day and catch up on anything you missed at chapelboro.com/forum on the hill.
Welcome back into Forum on the Hill here on 97.9 The Hill. I'm Brighton McConnell. We are about halfway through our K-12 education forum. In studio with me is Dr. Naya Hamlet, the superintendent of Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools. From Orange County Schools, we also have Connie Crimmins, who's the executive director of pre-K services and the exceptional children services at the district, as well as Dr. Chris Gammon, who's the executive director of curriculum and instruction. Again, thank you all for joining us. And we did have the mental health chat and the COVID-19 chat. There's so much else to cover when it comes to schools, though. Unfortunately, we've got to try and squeeze it into this back half of the hour. I do want to start with talking a little bit about addressing achievement gaps in both of our district. I know that that is something that much before the pandemic started, was something that our community especially has tried to focus on with our districts, because it's important to want to improve access to opportunity for all students versus just white students. Also addressing barriers that exist for communities of color and families who have lower income. So we kind of talked about some elements that work into the achievement gap in the first half, but we know that it's certainly something that's not been helped by the pandemic. So I want to start with you again, Dr. Hamlin, on this one. What are some of the ways that you consistently see and you consistently hear about the achievement gap when it comes to Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools?
Well, I will say that that's something that was one of the first things that was brought to my attention, especially as I was, you know, researching the district prior to my arrival. I think one of the things that we hear a lot about is how you measure or how you define the gaps that exist, right? So, you know, we might measure by student performance on end of grade or end of course assessments. But I think sometimes we have to also look at what are those assessments telling us, but also how are those assessments designed? And how do we as a school district community define success? So that's one of the biggest things that we've been grappling with as a district. No one has the silver bullet to closing the gaps that exist. So a couple of things that we're focused on. Number one is our discipline disparities for Black and brown children, recognizing that the more students are in school and not out of school, suspended out of school, the more that they'll be able to access their education and be successful, right? Mm-hmm. Quote unquote successful. The other thing is really being transparent and intentional about the way that we use data. So we just incorporated school profiles, data profiles that are now on our website. So you can click on any school. There's a school logo and you can click on any school and you just get inundated with all of this data. Our staff can drill down, right? Drill down to the data to the student, but it also is a way for us to really look at our data protocols to determine what students need and how we might adjust our instructional practices to meet them where they are. And so I could probably talk about this all afternoon, so I'll leave a little time for Orange County Schools, but I will say really focusing on how we look at data and how we define success.
Sure. And so now turning to OCS, I think it's fair to say the achievement gap for Orange County Schools, maybe not as highly covered as the CHCCS one is. I think there's usually a lot more focus on that one, but we know that that certainly exists in this district too. I want to turn to you, Chris, mm-hmm. as the director of mm-hmm. curriculum. How does knowing that that gap exists and trying to address it affect how, you know, Orange County Schools approaches its curriculum and operations?
Yeah, I believe for our team, you know, it starts with acknowledging that there are pervasive gaps that have been there well before the pandemic.
Right.
I think having that understanding, and as Dr. Hamlin referenced, you know, those conversations and awareness that that's happening, and it's always about the questions that you ask, the questions that you're asking about the data, what is the data telling us, that's going to help drive the decisions that you make when you're trying to problem solve on behalf of students. I do know for us, a couple of key focus areas, and we're in the midst now of finalizing our new five-year strategic plan. A couple of core focus areas that Dr. Hamlin referenced one earlier is the disparities with discipline data, especially with Black and brown students. But also really looking from an academic standpoint in the space of literacy, and really looking at those foundational years, because we truly believe it's about your why. Yes, there is a data point that comes out at the end of every school year, but our why is to provide opportunity and access for all students, so that they can be in a space where there are a lifetime of opportunities for them when they leave Orange County Schools. And I do know that we view literacy as a civil right. That, you know, there is data that supports, you know, the fourth grade literacy rate. If students are not literate by that time, that they literally build prisons for folks that are in that space where they may be illiterate at that age. You can see a correlation or a transparency or a connection in that data. Mm-hmm. So I think us understanding that we have a civil right to ensure that we are providing that access at the lowest foundational level of K-5 so that students have that opportunity and access. So those are two really critical focus areas for us. And in order to get to that, Our core instruction, we know that if there are pervasive gaps over a lengthy period of time, there's a first look is in your core instructional space. Like, how are you using your time every day? What does your instruction, what does your curriculum, what does the environment look like? Because we believe that for students, that there's that notion of there's a window and there's a mirror, and we want to make sure that our students are seeing a reflection of their culture, of themselves, in the instructional practices that are present, in the curriculum that we select, and really in the environment that we're creating. So I think that those pieces, we see that as a five-year journey with this strategic plan, but we also know that we're going for much more than that.
Sure, and I know that part of making that strategic plan, I obviously taking a look at curriculum, and that's certainly one approach, and taking a look at data, also another important approach, but so is community outreach to the communities communities that are being served by the districts. And I'm curious, Dr. Hamlet, during your time as superintendent, you've set up some other offices within the district to try and work on racial equity and taking a look at that, and the achievement gap kind of fits into that. What are some ways that your administration has been trying to work on that community outreach to just gather as much info as possible?
Well, one of the things that we did early on when I started was we merged our Department of Equity and our Department of Family and Community Engagement so that we can, I keep using this word intentional today, but so that we could be intentional about our outreach and our engagement of communities that tend to be marginalized. And so our equity, we have a chief equity and engagement officer who leads that work and works with those teams and schools and community partners. And, you know, we bring those community partners into and the families into these conversations that we're having. So if you notice, Dr. Gammon did not mention one thing about any issues that come with families who are marginalized, right? He didn't say anything about the circumstances of Black and brown families or students with disabilities, for that matter. Everything that he focused on is how can we as educators adjust our practices within our sphere of influence and our control. And so I think the key thing that we're trying to do as it relates to bringing in partners is really focusing in on what can we do as a collective school district community, rather than I think what may have taken place, not just in this community, but for years, when the achievement gap or opportunity gap discussion comes up, is point fingers and say, but the family didn't, or the student doesn't. We can't do that anymore. So one thing I always say is, you know, our students don't have time to wait for us to get it right. And we try to move forward with a sense of urgency, and that sense of urgency is in partnership with our communities and our families.
Sure, sure. Kind of a similar question back to you. How do you guys work on hearing from those students and families to better address those needs and all of their needs, frankly?
Yeah, so we have a lot of different things. So our chief equity officer, Dr. Dina Keeling, has had multiple conversations with high school students. Our superintendent has begun roundtables with students, with staff, not just certified staff and teachers, but our classified staff. And then parent roundtables. I know that I lead a group, it's in its infancy, but talking with parents of students with disabilities. We have our English language development coordinator, Miss Emily Lewis, who's working. We have a whole family engagement office that there are family liaisons. So really, it's how do we bring the community to us, but also then how do we push out to the community? So if you think about parent nights, and again, we talk about this, but now we are in the state of doing. If we have parent nights, how do we, first of all, flex our hours, because not every parent can come between 4 and 6, but also how do we go out to where the parents are? And I know that our family engagement office has worked really hard at helping us to think differently about engagement. And I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. We have a few minutes left, and so I think these final topics, we'll kind of do them in quick hit style, although
sure,
they are such deep topics, it's really hard to do that. Let's talk a little bit about infrastructure, just because I know that that is always a hot topic for district leadership, because especially in our region, our districts are growing. There's always a lot of infrastructure needs. Dr. Hamlet, what are some of the most pressing needs in your mind for CHCCS when it comes to infrastructure, whether that's along the lines of planning for growth, keeping student safety in mind, or just some of the most immediate things that need to be addressed?
Yeah, so I'll start with the safety piece and then I'll talk about facilities just very briefly. So from a safety perspective, we have just some lessons learned and some things that we need to focus on based on safety assessments that have been done previously. We actually have a team of folks who are in collaboration with our local police departments who are walking schools over the next couple of weeks before the break to just do an assessment of, you know, transition times or lunchtime or who has access to certain areas of a building, to really just kind of look at what those safety needs are. And then we're developing a multi-year plan to determine, you know, how we allocate our resources to improve our safety measures. Mm-hmm. From a building infrastructure perspective, the county commissioners, in collaboration with our two school boards, have initiated a task force to really take a look at our facility needs. And, you know, I know in Chapel Hill Carborough, we have some pretty old buildings, aging buildings, I will say. And so we have updated or in the process of updating our facilities assessment so that we can get a better sense of what our true facilities needs are, and then to determine how we best utilize funds, because, you know, we could certainly do some full renovations on buildings that are more than 25 years old. And we could also, you know, make some significant improvements along the way. So it's really just kind of that cost benefit analysis to determine how we really support our schools and our staff to make sure that they have the best learning environments possible.
Sure. And there is already an existing example, too, of Chapel Hill High School kind of redoing it from the ground up, too, which, how has that been going so far with students back in the classroom? It seems like an incredible facility.
Oh, it is a beautiful facility. And the children and staff just light up when they walk through those doors. There's flexible seating, there's wonderful lighting, but I think what is most rewarding for the Chapel Hill High School community is to be able to, again, come out of the pandemic and the school closures and come and walk into a building that was built just for them. And that has just been such a joy.
Same question now to Orange County Schools. When you think of infrastructure, what are some of the needs that pop into your heads?
Yeah, I would say we again would echo a lot of what Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools has shared. I mean, there are certainly building infrastructure needs. We have, you know, several of our facilities that are very dated, that we know that there are a lot of capital improvements that could occur there. I know our team is of course working with Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools, as was referenced earlier, about some of those future opportunities and plans. I know internally when we're thinking more of human capital, and we've referenced it some earlier in the show, but us just constantly looking at the needs of students in the buildings, whether it's, you know, from a mental health standpoint, it could be, you know, physical safety standpoint, working very close with our law enforcement, our school resource officers to make sure that we have that frequent, constant presence in schools, making sure that our safety plans and protocols are updated, but also we're vigilant that we're constantly revising them and make sure we're adhering to those. And I would say, too, that any of the grant opportunities that are out there, any of those grant funds that we seek out on an annual basis, or things that may be new as a part of the pandemic, we've tried to be very intentional in increasing some of that human capital as far as mental health support services for students, just to make sure that we are meeting those needs in any way that we can.
Connie, is there anything that you want to say to build off that?
Yeah, so we had a safety audit several years ago, but it's nice to see that those things have been implemented. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just, oh, we're having this audit, but we now have vestibules. We have to badge into our buildings. All of our perimeter doors have badge systems. So even just that simple step, knowing that I'm not, A, going to be caught on the playground, unable to get in, but that our teachers, if they go out with a class, they have a means to get back in. And I think Orange County Schools does a great job of always looking, always thinking. Our deputy superintendent of operations is big on let's close our work orders. So if you think about it, if we have a door that doesn't latch, That's a safety issue. So making sure that those work orders get in, that our staff knows how to access a work order, and then close out a work order. So simple things like that, just to keep our building safe and clean and up to par so that students can learn. And that's one thing that is off the teacher's plate and off of the student's plate.
Yeah, because sometimes that's all the difference that it makes. And it's not, you know, infrastructure needs. I think especially with our community, sometimes we think of the big, we need a complete renovation. But sometimes it's just as simple as getting a door fixed, making sure a lock is right and all that. Now, this is kind of a big picture question to end on, and one that I think we could probably spend a full hour talking about. But obviously, teaching in North Carolina and working in education in North Carolina is not a particularly easy prospect. I'm curious, starting with you, Dr. Hamlet, in your mind, what does the future of teaching and teaching recruitment look like? Because I know that right now it's challenging, and we're also in this in-between period of technology, in-person learning, that as we kind of learned from the pandemic, where the future can change on us pretty quickly in terms of how education is just done.
So I think one of the things that we are trying to do is really to focus in on how we retain our teachers. We're certainly trying to ramp up and be as innovative as possible with recruitment strategies, recognizing that there's clearly a teacher shortage, an educator shortage, not just across the state, but across the country. I mean, we have 191 vacancies in our district, and we, you know, have 2,000 employees. That's just, to me, a sign of the times. So with that, we do, it's just the little things. You know, for example, I went and visited for our beginning teachers, a BT teachers booster program. So just to share a little boost to our brand new teachers, where we might go visit them or, you know, give them a little gift or write them a nice little note just to tell them how appreciated they are, spend a little time in their classrooms. So our district leaders have been doing that. So I got a chance to see my beginning teacher today. And then just really focusing in on, again, letting the data tell us what's next. So, you know, gone are the days where we can say math, science, and special education are the shortage areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a shortage everywhere. And so at this point, it's really about kind of our reality and expressing that to our university partners and teacher preparation programs, and really trying to grow our own with our own students and encourage them to go into education and giving them incentives to, you know, work hard, go off to college, get this degree, and come back and give to your community in this way. And so I wish I, again, had the magic bullet and the thing that's going to, you know, answer all of our concerns as it relates to teacher recruitment. But I do know that our HR team is working so hard to recruit, but also to retain the staff that we have and to really support them.
Before arriving at CHCCS, you were a superintendent and assistant superintendent up in Virginia. Can you share a little bit of the difference in environment that you've seen in teaching in Virginia and the resources there versus the resources in North Carolina?
Sure. So I was in three districts prior to here. I was a chief of staff in Loudoun County, Virginia, which is Northern Virginia, which is a very large district and well-resourced district. And then I was also in Henrico County, which is right outside of Richmond, Virginia. And prior to that, I was in Virginia Beach City Public Schools. The one thing that I always say is probably one of my biggest gaps or blind spots coming here to North Carolina is how little local control we have as compared to Virginia. So there are different opportunities and of responsibility that the local school boards and superintendents in Virginia have that sometimes bind us here in North Carolina. So there are so many, my team laughs at me because I'm like, oh, there's a law for that too. So, you know, I would say that one of the biggest things that I've seen is really just, you know, trying to figure out how to navigate, you know, just the various legislation that kind of ties our hands in certain areas. And then working with our local school board, I know my school board has been a tremendous help in really advocating for what's right and just doing the best that we can to make sure that we are sending a message that education is a calling and education is still a great reward. And that it's not as bad as sometimes the local media, no offense, the media can make it seem. So, you know, really just sending that message of positivity and working within the realm that we can.
Turning back to Orange County schools, what are we looking at in terms of teacher recruitment and trying to retain our teachers too?
Yeah, it's very similar. You know, it's are we well resourced, right? And I think that's first and foremost because, well, along with a bunch of other things, but you know, I look at it this way: if I can provide my special education teachers or the general education teachers what they need. Because there's a science and an art to teaching, and we want to make sure that both of those are honored. So if they have the tools to honor that, we're going to have fulfilled teachers. And I think that's the one is, do I come to work every day and do I leave fulfilled? And that might be something simple. It might be an incentive. It might be a bonus. It might be you came, a central service person came by my classroom. And that is, there's so many things. But again, it to me, it's, am I in the place where I'm going to be fulfilled at the end of the day? Have I done right by children? And us as district leaders, are we doing right by our children? Because they are the ones that are impacting. So yes, all of the technical things, higher ed, but to me, really, it is that bottom line of the working environment each and every day.
Chris, do you want to build off that to wrap us up?
Yeah, I believe, and I can use a sports analogy. We recruit, and you want to recruit talented players. If it's an athletic team, we want to recruit talented teachers, but we also want to recruit folks that we know are invested and bought into Orange County schools. And that could be that process of growing your own. We are looking more internally of students that have that personal investment in the community already, because it's where they've been raised, and they kind of have that. That you know, future perspective of wanting to give back to their community, but that recruitment process too, in order to retain, that recruitment doesn't stop once they sign on to become a teacher. Mm-hmm. It is about that support. It is about the growth that you can invest into a person, so that you're constantly recruiting them while they're on your team, so that they can then in turn go out and recruit others to join the team as well. So I think that we're kind of in that space now where we want to be innovative in the way that we partner with local universities. The way that we focus on hiring practices and who we're looking for to recruit, because again, from an equity standpoint, making sure that we are providing the best resources possible for our students. But I think at the end of the day, it really is about just actively recruiting folks, but then it's about the supports. It's about our school board, as they've always done, really working diligently to provide a competitive supplement and to constantly listen to our teachers' voices and to what's happening in districts around us to know what can we do to continue to stay in that race to be competitive.
Well, we knew that we were never going to get to all of these conversations in an hour, but if you want to check out what each of these districts are doing on many of these topics that we've been talking about, chccs.org, the Chapel Hill Carbon City Schools website, and orangecountyfirst.com is the Orange County Schools website. Dr. Naya Hamlet, Connie Crimmins, and Dr. Chris Gammon, thank you all so much for joining us today on our K-12 education panel. We really appreciate you guys being part of the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break here on 97.9 The Hill. Your time is 5 o'clock. When we come back, it'll be time for our health and wellness panel. You're listening to The Forum on the Hill.
Stay tuned for more community conversations on The Forum on the Hill. Only on 97.9 The Hill and chapelboro.com. From 4 to 6 p.m. each day this week, we'll talk with lawmakers, educators, health professionals, and local leaders in an effort to promote collaboration on community-wide issues. Let's navigate the path forward together. Presented by Alliance Health, Chapel Hill Transit, Durham Technical Community College, Grub Properties, Trinsic Residential Group, and UNC Health. The Forum on the Hill, only on 97.9 The Hill and chapelboro.com. Your hometown radio station, 97.9 The Hill, WCHL, Chapel Hill. Streaming live on chapelboro.com.
Orange County residents looking for an affordable way to